Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry Truman, General Douglas MacArthur, Aniron Bevin, Lionel Barrymore, Senator Robert Taft, Senator Charles Toby, a special report on Moonshine USA, and more than 50 other men and women in the news in the 22nd performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
The stakes are a lot more important than the outcome of an election. The thing that is at stake in this debate may be atomic war.
The great difficulty about our American friends is that they are so big, so efficient, that when they start something, they rock everybody else.
I've just been reading about the atomic bomb. I don't see why they don't drop it. Because since you tore up the keg and you've destroyed all the stills and the boys and the hollers all gone to jail, the end of the world has already happened.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for air based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
1,300 pages a week, 50,000 words a day. No congressional hearing in history had ever been so well reported.
New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Sun-Times, New York Herald Tribune, fast.
The sound you hear is the duplicating room in the Senate, where every hour, every day since last Thursday, the MacArthur-Marshall testimony has been censored, stenciled, mimeographed, and in batches of 20 pages at a time handed out to every newspaper which would buy them at 12 cents a page. The voice you hear is the chief clerk handing the mimeographed pages out to the subscribing papers.
London News Chronicle, Chicago Daily News, got it? London Express, San Francisco Chronicle, that's it. New York News, Daily Worker.
In a matter of minutes, teletype operators were transmitting the text of the MacArthur-Marshall testimony to newspapers and radio stations throughout the world. A few papers printed all the testimony. By tonight, most of what both sides could say and would say had been said. Those cautious enough at the time of the MacArthur removal to say, let's wait and see what MacArthur, the president, and the Joint Chiefs have to say, now had sufficient evidence to start working on a conclusion. Actually, the MacArthur-Marshall testimony of the past week was little more than an elaboration of what both General MacArthur and President Truman had said in their speeches of the last 30 days. We have joined together and edited in juxtaposition the most salient points of both sides of this greatest of all debates, together with portions of the hearings, in an effort to define more closely that area where they disagree and also that area in which they agree.
I do not stand here as advocate for any partisan cause, for the issues are fundamental and reach quite beyond the realm of partisan consideration. They must be resolved on the highest plane of national interest. We are right in the midst of a big debate on foreign policy. A lot of people are looking at this debate as if it were just a political fight. But the stakes are a lot more important than the outcome of an election. The thing that is at stake in this debate may be atomic war. Our foreign policy is not a political issue.
The general and the president agreed at the start. The national interest, that means your interest and my interest, required that this debate be above politics, even if it took place in Washington, D.C. For most of us, the major interest in this debate centered on individuals, the men now doing the talking, and the men who have been and will be doing the fighting and the dying. General MacArthur speaking of his troops and the war to the Congress.
It was my constant effort to preserve them and end this savage conflict honorably and with the least loss of time and a minimum sacrifice of life. Its growing bloodshed has caused me the deepest anguish and anxiety.
In his testimony to the senators, the general was a little blunter. He said if the fight continues in accordion fashion, the cumulative losses will be staggering, a slaughter. Thousands upon thousands of Americans would die. The president is equally distressed by the casualty figures.
I do not want to hear anyone say that our effort in Korea has been wasted. Our men there have been fighting for you and for me and for every one of us, for our homes, our futures, and the future of our children just as surely as if they were fighting on our own soil. They are fighting in Korea to save us from having to fight on our own soil.
The Secretary of Defense Marshall, himself a five-star general, told the Senate committees that he, too, was conscious of tragedy on the battlefield. He had memories of the last war. But he said, it is the hard duty of those responsible for overall strategy to make decisions on the wisest course to follow for the ultimate result. And the president feels that he is following the wisest course.
I am convinced that the course we are now following in Korea is accomplishing most for peace. And at the least cost in American lives, all of us wish that no Americans had to fight or die. But by fighting on a limited scale now, we may be able to prevent a third world war later on.
So, as from all Americans, we have distress at the dead, the missing, and the wounded in Korea. In his speech to the Congress, General MacArthur spoke an unpopular word and attributed it to the administration.
There are some who, for varying reasons, would appease Red China. They are blind to history's clear lesson. For history teaches with unmistakable emphasis that appeasement but begets new and bloodier war.
The president agrees.
We will not engage in appeasement. We will make no deals that would reward aggression. Let there be no mistake in the Kremlin. We want peace in Korea and in the rest of the world. But we will not give in to aggression. We know that appeasement does not lead to peace. Appeasement leads to war.
Here we have the president and the general in agreement. Appeasement leads to war. And we have the help of the general's definition of the word. In my lexicon, he told the senators, anything that doesn't tend to stop the war is appeasement. So the area of agreement is narrowed. Let's turn now to the area of disagreement. General MacArthur.
I call for reinforcements, but was informed that reinforcements were not available. I made clear that if not permitted to destroy the enemy build-up bases north of the Yalu, if not permitted to utilize the friendly Chinese force of some 600,000 men on Formosa, if not permitted to blockade the China coast to prevent the Chinese Reds from getting succor from without, and if there were to be no hope of major reinforcements, the position of the command from the military standpoint forbade victory.
Secretary Marshall's testimony gave much attention to this statement. The secretary says, we can visualize no considerable relief for Korea. Once in August, General MacArthur turned down 33,000 Chinese nationalist troops because he felt they were ineffective, lacked logistical support. But more recently, the general has called for 50 to 60,000 of these same troops. As for the blockade of Red China, we have been doing all we could. Until this week, our allies were less than anxious to follow our example. But now the British have come round. Quite a change, the secretary called it. And the British are prepared now to support our demand in the United Nations for a complete embargo. That leaves, in the MacArthur program, the business of bombing enemy bases in communist China. The president's view on that.
You may ask, why can't we take other steps to punish the aggressor? Why don't we bomb Manchuria and China itself? Why don't we assist the Chinese nationalist troops to land on the mainland of China? If we were to do these things, we would be running a very grave risk of starting a general war. It's the exact situation we're trying to prevent.
But General MacArthur, in his Senate testimony, insisted, remove the inhibitions from our air and naval forces. Permit them to strike hard and wherever the command wants them to strike. And it would not take very many more ground troops to wind up the war. But the president had considered this.
The best military advice I've been able to obtain, the best collective military advice in this country, is that this course of action would not lead to a quick and easy solution of the Korean conflict. On the contrary, it could very well lead to a much bigger and a much longer war. Such a war would not reduce our casualties in the Far East. It would increase them enormously. Furthermore, a deep involvement on our part in a war in China, whatever the outcome there, would have critical military consequences in Europe. There is nothing that would give the Kremlin greater satisfaction than to see our resources committed to an all-out struggle in Asia, leaving Europe exposed to Soviet armies.
The investigating senators asked General Marshall, in effect, who is deciding what our troops do and where they go, our commanders or our allies? The secretary said, we decide. But we carefully consider the views of our partners, our allies, as well as the views of the theater commander, the man leading and directing the fighting in Korea. General MacArthur.
For entertaining these views, all professionally designed to support our forces committed to Korea and bring hostilities to an end with the least possible delay and at the saving of countless American and Allied lives, I have been severely criticized in lay circles, principally abroad, despite my understanding that from a military standpoint, the above views have been fully shared and passed by practically every military leader concerned with the Korean campaign, including our own Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That was perhaps the biggest news in the general's speech to the Congress. Secretary of Defense Marshall was questioned on details for hours. Briefly, he said this. The views the Joint Chiefs of Staff had shared were based on the probability of evacuating our troops from Korea. And Republican Senator Morse, who heard the testimony, called them tentative and conditional views. General MacArthur claimed sharing his military views with the Joint Chiefs. But long testimony before the senators made it clear that he had his suspicions. Suppose he was asked, the Joint Chiefs decide on a Far Eastern policy other than yours. Will you support their views? The general said those views would have to pass the bar of public opinion. Then he was asked, do you support their estimates of how large the armed forces should be? How much money we should spend to train and equip fighting men? In this area, General MacArthur would accept the recommendations of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We have yet to hear the testimony of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I have strongly recommended in the past, as a matter of military urgency, that under no circumstances must Formosa fall under communist control.
On Formosa, no matter past decisions and discussions, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the President, and the Secretary of Defense now are in agreement with General MacArthur. Secretary Marshall told the senators, we are all of the opinion that it is of great importance and imperative that Formosa be kept out of red hands. But this is a Far Eastern issue. General MacArthur, in his message to the Congress, was thinking on a bigger scale.
The issues are global and so interlocked that to consider the problems of one sector oblivious to those of another is but to court disaster for the whole. There are those who claim our strength is inadequate to protect on both fronts, that we cannot divide our effort. I can think of no greater expression of defeatism.
That posed two problems for the administration. One, are the issues global? Two, is it defeatism to claim that we can't fight on two fronts? Secretary Marshall, in 5 days of testimony, offered his answers to both questions. He recalled that General MacArthur's testimony had made it very clear that global consequences had not been apparent to MacArthur, that MacArthur spoke as a theater commander. Is it defeatism to say we can't fight on two fronts? Secretary Marshall had a simple answer. We can't. We don't have what it takes. We're not prepared. And our allies are worse off than we are. But General MacArthur had insisted that in Korea it was essential to spread the area of attack, to remove the inhibitions on our Air Force.
Why, my soldiers asked of me, surrender military advantages to an enemy in the field? I could not answer. Some may say, to avoid spread of the conflict into an all-out war with China. Others, to avoid Soviet intervention. Neither explanation seems valid, for China is already engaging with the maximum power it can commit, and the Soviet will not necessarily mesh its actions with our moves.
The President's answer.
We have been urged to take measures which would spread the fighting in the Far East. We've been told that this would bring the Korean conflict to a speedy conclusion, that it would save the lives of our troops. In my judgment, that just isn't true. I believe we have a better chance of stopping aggression in Korea at a smaller cost in lives by following our present course.
Our present course or the MacArthur course? The general insisted that if we do not meet the threat in Korea, we are doomed. We are surrendering the situation to the communists in the Far East. Secretary Marshall was asked, isn't it more dangerous, more provocative of a Russian attack to send our troops to Europe? He answered, it was a risk. Send the troops or surrender the situation to the Soviets. Again, the senators turned to the Russians. If we bomb communist China, what will communist Russia do? General MacArthur said, the Russians cannot conduct a major offensive in the Far East. Their five divisions in Siberia are in a defensive posture. Their railroad from Eastern Europe is overworked. He thinks there is a certain degree of risk, but he does not believe the Russians would enter the war if we bomb China's bases.
It has been categorically stated that Russia will not come in if we bomb Manchuria. That statement was made to me about the Chinese not coming into Korea. And it was made on good authority, too, and I believed it.
General MacArthur was asked about this. He said his intelligence on the Far East was limited, but the Secretary of State and the Central Intelligence Agency had agreed that there was little chance of any major intervention in the Korean War by the Chinese. But Secretary Marshall does not agree with General MacArthur's intelligence on the Russians. Secretary Marshall says they have thousands of planes surrounding Korea in Vladivostok, Port Arthur, Dairen, Harbin. They have former Japanese troops on Sakhalin, just to the north of the northernmost Japanese island. They have a tremendous power of retaliation. The Joint Chiefs of Staff believe that if we adopt the MacArthur program, Russia might feel compelled to come to the aid of communist China. If Russia strikes in Asia, that means World War III. Then, what is to happen in Korea? How is the war to end?
Once war is forced upon us, there is no other alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. In war, there is no substitute for victory.
That was a statement the administration could not easily answer. But we, all of us, wanted an answer. The president offered his view.
The Chinese rulers are losing large numbers of their soldiers. As these losses increase, it will become clearer and clearer to them that aggression does not pay. They can have peace when they give up their aggression and stop the fighting. If we stick to our guns and continue to punish the aggressors, we can end the aggression in Korea and restore peace.
And Secretary Marshall spelled it out in his testimony. We must kill more Chinese, break their morale, destroy the trained fiber of their army. If we do this, we have the best chance of reaching a negotiatory basis. But he said, if the Russians give the Chinese help, while we cannot add to our troop strength, the Chinese cannot be driven out of Korea. Secretary Marshall explained what we have been doing for the past 5 years. We have been curbing aggression, meeting the Red Challenge, and helping our allies. We did it in Iran and Greece and Turkey. We did it in Trieste and Berlin, and now Korea. Month by month, year by year, we opposed the communists with courage and poise, with firmness, determination, and patience. The Secretary of Defense says that in Korea there can be no quick solution. The policy we are following now is just about the only policy we can follow. But is it? General MacArthur thinks otherwise.
I shall work with you in the discharge of our common responsibilities of citizenship to the end that American policy be based upon the thoughts and the needs and the aspirations of the American people, unyielding to undue and exaggerated political pressures from abroad.
The general defined those political pressures at the Senate hearings. He thought our allies carry too much weight in the Common Council for the contribution they have made to the common cause in Korea. He would like as many allies as possible. If the present United Nations troops should be withdrawn by their governments, it would not hurt the tactical situation. They are so few in number. But, he said, it would be tragic. Yet, the general thinks, if others cannot see where appeasement leads, cannot see that we are following that road in Asia, then we had better protect ourselves and go it alone. The president speaks.
If the United States were to widen the conflict, we might well have to go it alone. If we go it alone in Asia, we may destroy the unity of the free nations against aggression. Our European allies are nearer to Russia than we are. They are in far greater danger. If we act without regard to the danger that faces them, they may act without regard to the danger that we face. Going it alone brought the world to the disaster of World War II. We cannot go it alone in Asia and go it in company in Europe.
General MacArthur is all for fighting communism in Europe, just as he would fight it in Asia. But his major concern is still Korea. And constantly, since the Chinese entered the war, he has made it known that he wanted new instructions. That is, new powers to launch new attacks on the new enemy who created the new war. But this was to be his big disappointment.
However great the effort to distract attention from the main issues by introducing into public discussion extraneous and irrelevant matters, the fundamental question still remains the same. What is the policy for Korea?
The general has his policy. Blockade the Chinese. Bomb their bases. Put the pressure on them. Don't send a single American onto the mainland of China, but use the Chinese nationalists. And the Chinese Reds would crack, be forced to talk peace. But as things are today, and as they were on the day of his dismissal, he could ask again, what is the policy for Korea? The day the general was dismissed, the president offered his answer.
I want to be clear about our military objective. We are fighting to resist an outrageous aggression in Korea. We are trying to keep the Korean conflict from spreading to other areas. But at the same time, we must conduct our military activities so as to ensure the security of our forces. This is essential if they are to continue the fight until the enemy abandons this ruthless attempt to destroy the Republic of Korea. That is our military objective, to repel attack and to restore peace.
We have tried to present the major issues in this very serious debate. The major issues, but one. One that will be debated by the partisans and historians and the civilians for decades to come. Why was General MacArthur dismissed? In the Senate testimony, this question came up again and again. There were many answers. May I attempt to summarize the record to date? General MacArthur says, I don't know why I was recalled. I am completely uninformed. The president's reasons are not valid. I could not oppose policies I was not aware of. Any insinuation that in any way I ever failed to carry out instructions is unworthy and unwarranted. And the manner of my dismissal jeopardized the interests of the United States. I felt the responsibility to speak out. No more subordinate officer ever wore the uniform of the United States. To which another five-star general of equally great service to the country, the Secretary of Defense, General Marshall, replied. It was wholly unprecedented, the way MacArthur made public his displeasure with his government's policy. He violated my precepts and understanding as a soldier. When an officer takes a commission, he accepts certain inhibitions not shared by politicians, lawyers, or businessmen. It distresses me to speak this way about a brother officer. But General MacArthur, by his public statements, he never violated a military order, threatened collective action with our allies, gave our foreign policy two voices. General MacArthur forgot that sometimes a good press may be a very bad business. The busy little subway running underground between the Senate chamber and the Senate office building worked overtime, with heavy loads of senators commuting back and forth between the hearings in the caucus room and the Senate floor. Although there were many voices and much excitement, there were few yet willing to stand up and be counted on any issue other than that MacArthur is right or Truman is right. Senator John Sparkman, Democrat of Alabama, was one of the few Democrats to be specific.
Here are some of the things taken from the record as the general has told us. General MacArthur has said his knowledge of global problems is only that which is necessary for a theater commander. If the Russians should react to the proposed bombing of Manchuria by attacking us, General MacArthur has no proposals for the defense of America. He says, and I quote his words, "That doesn't happen to be my responsibility." General MacArthur doesn't know if we are increasing our armed forces fast enough or if they are big enough. He will accept the Joint Chiefs' professional opinions on this, if it is given without obligations or pressure. But he is not inclined to accept the Joint Chiefs' conclusion for a Far Eastern policy. That, he says, has to pass the bar of public opinion. General MacArthur also testified, "The Joint Chiefs will have to say when we are best prepared for war." He says he is not posing as an expert on world affairs. It is not within his responsibility to plan for a Russian atomic attack or sabotage. It seems to me that General MacArthur has not only made a brilliant case for his position, but he's also made a brilliant case against his position. Perhaps we should say that he has made a brilliant case for the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Senator McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin, left no doubt as to where he stood on the subject of General Marshall.
Apparently, Marshall and Acheson et al. Have decided that in order to keep Russia out, we can't let Communist China lose the Korean War. Secretary Marshall's testimony in regard to the Chinese Air Force being built up, our failure to conduct reconnaissance, the danger of their hitting our troops, would indicate to me beyond any doubt that we're preparing for another planned Pearl Harbor, which will be much, much bloodier than the last one. And as I've said, during any other period of history, during any other administration, I think that someone would hang for this treachery.
The Korean War was being debated in halls other and older than our Congress. In Britain, Aniron Bevan, leader of the extreme left wing of the Labour government, who 2 weeks ago walked out of the Attlee government because he thought that Britain, like America, was arming too fast for war, said this.
The great difficulty about our American friends is that they are so big, so efficient, that when they start something, they rock everybody else.
In this strangest of all possible worlds and wars, it is indeed strange that the political opinions of the extreme left in the British government and the extreme right in Washington should be saying almost the same thing. Not on all matters, to be sure. But here are socialist Bevan and conservative Senator Robert Taft saying almost identical words on the subject of rearmament. First, Mr. Bevan, this week.
I don't believe that the main weapon with which to fight Soviet communism is military. I believe it's social and political. You'll never keep it back by arms alone. In fact, I am convinced that if you try an arm on the present scale, that itself will produce the poverty that will make Soviet communism successful.
Last week in Washington, the senator from Ohio said,
I don't believe the government can take one-third of the national product, even if you balance the budget, without inflation. It is an impossible situation. You do that, you eliminate all freedom at home, the very thing you're trying to protect. You set up a garrison state, you defeat your own ends. As I say, you threaten the very production of the United States.
In Korea, the month of May, which arrived almost unnoticed against the din and turmoil of the communist offensive, was officially welcomed by the troops and the Koreans as they enjoyed a temporary respite in the fighting. The Korean children peddled May flowers in return for GI rations in garbage cans. The GIs lounged in the now high grass, basked in the sun, hung their laundry on their patent tanks, swam in the river they were supposed to have lost, wrote letters, and reminisced about the recent Red Offensive. On last week's program, you heard Captain Ray Blandon come out of the mountains looking like a combination Bill Malden-Ernie Pyle character and be asked,
"How long have you been up there?"
"I've been up there since yesterday."
"You have a rough night?"
"Rough night. I'll say we had a rough night."
This week, the beard, the haggard look, the bloodshot eyes were gone. Ray Blandon of the 3rd Division, which had held the line so brilliantly against 10-1 odds, leaned back against a tree stump and talked with a fellow infantryman, Owen Grogan of Memphis, about the battle they had won. Blandon's own company had killed an entire battalion.
The majority of the people that we killed in my sector were from close-in fire by my own men and mainly my 57-millimeter guns that I have had large stacks of dead bodies in front of each one. We personally counted them to give the men credit for them and found that we had 67 Chinese in front of one and 40 in front of my second gun and 37 in front of my third gun. We counted over 300 and we could see many more bodies that we couldn't count and estimated a round figure of 800 dead on the hilltop that my unit held.
And incidentally, that is now called Blandon's Slaughterhouse. And it's a very good name because if it hadn't been for Captain Blandon's unit, my unit would not have been able to pull back and get into position to block for other units to in turn pull back.
That was Captain Grogan, whom you hear now on the human sea the foe set against him and his men.
In the last operation, Captain Blandon's 57 knocked off the first two men, and the others walked right over their bodies and just kept coming. They didn't falter, stop, or take any passive action whatsoever. They just continued to come, and when you kill them in that way, you have to kill them all before you can stop them, because they're going to continue to come. They seem to have no fear.
They not only come in just waves when they come at you, a lot of them that you'll see coming into your position are unarmed and depend upon picking up weapons of the people that you either kill or wound to the front of them when they're coming into your position.
I noticed Ray kept busy, too, on the hill, didn't you, Ray? Destroying the Chinese weapons. There were several hundred around, and he kept several men busy as well as himself breaking these weapons up, because all of us feel now that every weapon that we can get away from them and deny them the use of will be one less weapon that'll be shooting at us.
That was the report of a couple of infantrymen whose job it is to kill men and win battles. Now here is a report from Lieutenant General Van Fleet, commander of the 8th Army, whose job it is to destroy divisions and win a war that some say may never be won.
Of some 600,000 troops believed to be immediately available to the enemy, one half were thrown against the UN lines in human sea tactics. However, the determined UN resistance, including massive artillery and air strikes, disrupted the enemy's long-planned offensive by inflicting heavy casualties. Air and ground reports estimate at least 70,000 enemy casualties, killed and wounded, in his bid for all-out victory.
70,000 casualties in 7 days. Then a reporter asked, "General, can we hold the Han River line?"
"Well, we're in good positions north of the Han now. It'll take considerable weight to dislodge us from those positions. I welcome the opportunity to destroy him there. We're ready for him north of the Han."
How does General Van Fleet feel about bombing Manchuria if the enemy strikes with air power?
"That's General Ridgway's decisions."
Lionel Barrymore was in the news this week. The eldest of the royal family of John, Ethel, and Lionel has written a new book called We Barrymores. It's a good book. And if you like Mr. Barrymore, it may even be a great book. And we happen to like him. We have asked Lionel Barrymore to read several of the choice passages of this book for us.
"I was born with a conviction to which I still hold that anything resembling work is a nauseating spectacle. My ridiculous and on occasion serious efforts to discover what I was fitted to do in life have produced a number of bad paintings and etchings and a large collection of songs, most of which I've thefted from real composers, which may someday be played in houses of careless reputation, if there are any of them left, for a cringing posterity. And I've been an actor. My second regret stems from this. Since I did, in spite of my wails and protests, keep getting promoted in the theater like a pebble pushed toward the top of the heap when its chief talent was for gathering lichen, I think it's not too unreasonable to mourn that I was never able to shove someone aside and carry a spear for my sister Ethel.
On his brother John.
What was the matter with my brother? I honestly don't know, and I don't think he did.
On John's upstaging.
The only instance in which Jack and I disagreed over a scene was during a sequence in which I had a long speech to say to him. He was to stand there and listen. But being an actor, and a great one, he couldn't quite do that. As I'd finished, Jack would lay his hand on my arm, upsetting my timing and attracting attention to himself as the sequence ended. I attempted to brush my astute brother off, but he seemed to be equipped like an octopus and reached for me every time. Finally, I asked permission to leave the set, went to a telephone, and I got Richard Boleslavsky, the director, on the line. Will you kindly instruct Mr. John Barrymore to keep his hands off me, lest at the close of this scene, I be tempted to lay one of them on him, I said.
Mr. Barrymore, on the incident when Eleanor Roosevelt refused to permit him to play FDR in a motion picture.
After the president's death, it was proposed to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer that I appear as FDR in the beginning of the end. I made a test and was considered all right. I didn't get the part, however, because when Mrs. Roosevelt heard about the casting, she said firmly that she would withhold permission if the terrible Barrymore played her husband. Well, this, of course, is all over the dam now, so I think I'll not be misunderstood if I say that although I was naturally disappointed by her rejection of me, I had then, and I now have, nothing but admiration for Eleanor Roosevelt for her attitude. I did not say or even think the things about her husband which I was supposed to have said, but those alleged sayings were reported to her, and she had every reason to believe them. Therefore, good for her. How lucky a man was Franklin Roosevelt to have such a wife.
Lionel Barrymore ends his book with a credo, which he borrows from Shakespeare and from his brother John.
As for the record, there are some lines in Macbeth which say the whole business. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is program 22 on Hear It Now. A full-hour review of the week's news, told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
2 months ago today, the Kefauver Crime Committee came to New York, and it was then that we were introduced to the big boys, the Costellos and Ericksons, the Adonises and Zwillmans. We heard much about politics, the liquor business, and tax evasion. And we heard Senator Toby say,
What you heard today here is not America. If you want to know what America is, go out in the hinterlands of this country, to the farm homes and the village homes, to the men who come home at night to greet a wife and little children, who pay their taxes and love America.
We heard nothing about mountain ethics, moonshining, and tax evasion. No one bothered to question Rattlesnake Pete, Slowfoot Harry, or Branchwater Finnegan. Possibly, they might have refused to answer questions on the ground that it might tend to incriminate them. But we doubt that. So tonight, as a supplement to the crime report and an oral document of Americana, we have decided to tell the story of Moonshining USA.
If the ocean was whiskey and I was a duck, I would die to the bottom.
It's an illegal operation, which each day cost the government in lost taxes the equivalent of a B-36, $4 million a day. We sent two reporters with recorders to the hinterland to cover an actual raid on a still. Before they left, Carol Mealy, head of the government's alcohol tax unit in Washington, told them,
"These booties are tax dodgers. They're breaking the law. Maybe it's a little bit more adventurous than the ordinary tax dodging. As far as we're concerned, too often we have to risk our hides chasing after the Mountain Dew and the boys who make it. So we leave the adventure and the romance to the story writers."
To get the story, reporters Ed Scott and Joe Wershba had to push their way through the foothills of Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains. Joe Wershba was obviously not in training for this assignment.
Yeah, come on, Joe. What do you know, Joe? Bro, this is murder.
But Jimmy Moore, age 58, a district investigator for 29 years, had spent a lifetime in the woods.
Walking is good for anybody. You can eat all you want. You can sleep 8 to 9 hours a night. And you have no worries at all as long as you'll walk 10 to 15 miles per day.
Not all illegal whiskey making is confined to the rural areas of the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, and Virginia. It's going on in the big cities, too, as Walter Carroll, assistant to the New York supervisor James Olson, can vouch for.
Here in New York, the biggest city in the world, we have moonshining, too, right in the shadow of the skyscrapers. They set up near garbage dumps to hide the alcohol smell. They build whole plants inside what look like abandoned buildings. They use fake businesses as fronts. Only last month, we raided a big illegal still in the Bronx. It was set up inside an old, unused movie studio. We have good reason to feel that in the biggest cities, there is a definite tie-up between those involved in the more sensationalized forms of crime and racketeering. Many of these people have their fingers in the alcohol racket, too.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains, like the cities, you inevitably run into the chronic complainer.
This country's drier than I ever seen it. I'm 36 years old next Sunday. And I've been born and raised in, and I've never seen whiskey scarce in my life.
The mountains have their elder statesmen, too. This one is 78. He's lived the full life. He could use a haircut, but he needs no expensive lawyer to refresh in his memory.
When I was born and raised in the mountain, like I told you, you could just go into them hollows, and I was just little pot stills, and liquor wasn't 25 cents a pint, but still the stills are small. They ain't like y'all now. Stills now will hold over, I'd say, 500 or 600 gallons. Stills will now. I saw some stills here a while back where somebody had cut. Biggest stills I ever saw in my life. Never saw such stills in my life. Biggest stills I ever saw is as much stills in the mountains as I've been in. Them's the biggest stills ever I saw. Biggest I ever saw.
If the stills are bigger than they were in the old days, what about the moonshine? We asked Rattlesnake Pete.
Yes, most used to be good. Most of it's pretty bad now. I don't have much whiskey at all now, and what it is not much good anymore.
Pete's a kindly mountaineer who's gone legit now, but he knows all about this sort of thing. Has the younger generation lost its touch, Pete?
Oh, they're too fast. They want to get it all done today. It takes time. You got to take your time, make good liquor. It takes a lot of time. You got to stay in there all day and part of the night and let it run slow and cold and make good liquor. If you run it fast and run it out in a hurry and it's hot and it'll burn you, it's no good.
An alcohol tax unit investigator has to be a diplomat in this sort of country. He has to be patient and understanding, and a sense of humor helps. Jimmy Moore qualifies on all counts.
I recall about 10 years ago, I went up in what we call Rattlesnake Hollow. I saw an old friend of mine up there who'd been in liquor business for years. He seemed to be down in the dips. I says, Charlie, what's the trouble with you today? He says, Uncle Jimmy, I've just been reading about the atomic bomb. I don't see why they don't drop it, because for me, the end of the world has already happened. I said, Charlie, what's all your worries? Well, he says, I used to keep a 10-gallon keg of liquor down at my spring. And when I'd get up in the morning, if I had the backache, the toothache, the headache, a rheumatism, or any other thing that might happen to my body, I'd go down and take a glass before breakfast. The pain was removed, and I was in much better shape. But now, since you tore up the keg and you've destroyed all the stills and the boys in the hollow's all gone to jail, I just have to keep my headache, my backache, and other stuff. As Charlie, you know we have ABC stores now. Have you tried that? Yes. He says, I bought a gallon of the stuff. I brought it in. I measured out a glass full. It made me sick. I gave it to my wife. It made her sick. And I carried it out to the pigs, and it killed two of my young pigs before I could get them away from it.
This is Antiseptic Sam. He has a recipe we're certain Oscar of the Waldorf never heard of.
If a man makes liquor right, and a fitting for any one to drink, he should wash out and clean out the still as clean as any cooked utensil as is in the kitchen. He takes his clear water, it boils, it's sterilized, then he pulls it into his box, he burns his boxes out before he puts his water in there, so he puts his water in there. Well, he puts his meal in there, and then that water cooks the meal just like you cook a piece of cornbread.
Fred is a jolly roly-poly mountaineer. He had to give up moonshining because his feet couldn't take it. He now runs a country store off one of the back roads. It isn't exactly a supermarket, but serves the area well. That is, when the shelves don't collapse. Our reporters interviewed him. Ask him first about his pappy.
Yeah, when I was small, I hoped him a little bit. After I got caught, I quit.
It's not right to do it that way.
No, it's not right. I learned better and got me a different job.
Well, how about the people who do it all the time?
They get in jail.
Well, I mean, do they think there's anything wrong about it?
They must not. Many of them catch around here.
What do you think about how do the people feel about the laws coming in on them?
They're wrong.
Do they think the government ought to be in here at all?
You're supposed to have some laws.
Sophisticated reporters from the big cities sometimes have trouble in the mountains. So a hometown man picks up the interview.
How long was you really in the game before you quit?
Not too long.
How come you to quit anyway?
Law caught me.
Well, just catch you one time, you out of it now for good?
Oh, caught me about 7-8 times.
Well, don't you think there's some money in it now?
Would have one scared to fool with it.
How come you scared?
Scared of law.
Fred has good reason to be scared. The maximum penalty for moonshining is 5 years in prison, $10,000 in fines. But the maximum is hardly ever meted out. What you're about to hear now is an actual raid on an illegal still, one of 20,000 seized last year. This is the brook from which the moonshiners get their branch water. And these moonshiners, who got their name because they usually work under the light of the moon, are chopping wood to heat the still. The revenuer is getting ready to close in. In the gully, surrounded by rocks and rolling hills, dawn is about to break, and so is an illegal still.
Make sure they're in position. I don't think we're running to a watchman now. As soon as I figure that they're in position, I'll let them go.
Hey, boy! Hey, boy! Hey, I'm here! I know you! Stop! Stop! Show up, man!
Here you are! Hey, Scully!
Bring them on in, boys! What are you running for, boy?
We got two of them. That's all there was here.
That's a good catch, Jimmy. That's the only two I saw working. What's your name, boy?
Your last name.
I know your first name.
My name's Higgins.
Is this your still, or you just working here?
Well, I'm just working here.
Who are you working for?
I don't hardly know.
How about you there, boy? What's your name?
My name's Martin.
Martin. What Martin?
Dillmore.
Who's your daddy?
That's none of your business.
Yes, it is. Now, don't give me a bunch of stuff. You're caught now. Is this your still, or you just working here for somebody?
My name's Dillmore.
Your name's Dillmore?
I'm just working here.
Okay.
More often than not, the real owner of the still is never caught. But always, the raided still is destroyed. Listen.
You got your dynamite ready, Jimmy?
All ready, boys. In just a few minutes, we'll have a shower.
Okay, we'll send it to the woods.
That blew an investment of about $1,000. It takes 10 gallons of mash, consisting of sugar, water, grain, and yeast, to make 1 gallon of liquor. It takes 2 to 3 days to distill. Is bottled in half-pint fruit jars. Sells for about $3 a gallon wholesale. Is painful to the human body and costs the government $9 a gallon in lost taxes. Those who get caught, like this fellow, who's in a two-story red brick modern country jail, recognize the hazards but have no hard feelings toward the revenuers.
I got by with 4 runs. They come in and got me, gave me probation, and told me to turn me loose if I'd quit. So I had to quit it. And the officers were real nice to me. Most of them are just like your next door neighbor, do anything in the world for you. We push them out of mud holes. They help us out, and we help them out. They'd walk a mile to do your accommodation. They'd walk 10 to catch you. Nice fellas, all of them are.
The revenuers, like Fred Morrell, a handsome, dark-haired, energetic youngster of 25, have no hard feelings either. They recognize the problem for what it is.
They're not criminals. We have a perfect working agreement with them. They know it will catch them if we have to. If they get in the liquor business, they'll get caught. And as long as they stay out, we won't bother them for other things. We get along with them. We do them favors. We put them on their honor, which they respect a lot. A lot of the men that we catch here take pride in coming in on their own instead of being handcuffed and brought in.
Jimmy Moore, the other investigator who went out with us on this assignment, has arrested many of these moonshiners before. He knows them well.
We meet them on the street. We meet them in the courtroom. We meet them at stills. There's never any abusive language used. There's never any shots fired. There's no handcuffs used. We treat them like real 100% Americans.
Worm Nose Harry has the highest regard for the revenuers, but is glad times have changed.
And they used to come in and they had a way of trying to scare a fellow. They'd shoot at his feet and make him think he was, and they don't do that anymore. They don't shoot at you. And that's a mighty good thing. A lot of people get killed accidentally. All it done was scare a fellow so bad he'd just run himself to death.
We asked another moonshiner if he thinks the industry is going to come back where it once was in the Prohibition days.
I don't think it'll ever be big like it once was.
The obvious question, why?
Well, they just ride around these radios and airplanes and bum you and strafe you and all that stuff.
The moonshiners live in a world all their own. They're not criminals in a real sense, though they definitely try to evade the income tax laws. Claude Cooper is the chief law enforcement officer of the Alcohol Tax Unit. He can tell you moonshine philosophy.
These moonshiners have their own pretty strict code of ethics. I remember this big gangling fellow that came into our office. Looked at our chief agent and said, John, I've known you for 25 years. You ain't playing foreign or square with me. John looked up and said, what do you mean ain't playing foreign or square? And this big fellow, he kept shaking his head and repeating, John, you ain't playing foreign or square with me. Because now you're tracking us down with talkie-talkies and airplanes.
Modern science has had its effect on moonshining as it has on everything else. As far as revenuer Jimmy Moore is concerned, this is good.
There's a lot of times in the past 29 years that I have been where I thought possibly that I would be with St. Peter in the next few seconds. On several different occasions, people have had guns on me. They've told me they was going to shoot. But now, when they get like that, don't get too soft, but get soft enough so you know the man won't pull the trigger.
There's a strong bond of loyalty among these people. Walkie-talkies and airplanes may bother them, but they can and will take on less formidable obstacles. Another investigator.
Well, there was the time we came on this still and hauled in the guy who was running it. I had to go back to blow up the still, so I handcuffed this fellow to a tree. When I got back, the guy was gone, and so was the tree.
With many moonshiners, their business is a proud heritage, as this one explains in what might be called the Stork Club of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
My father was, he was one that taught me how to make liquor. When I was 9 years old, I was standing on a box beside the still, stirring the still for my father. I built up long, I hope him, up till I was 14 years old. So I put up still myself. And I've run it, different stills through different sections from that time to this.
The U.S. attorney for the area, Howard Gilmer, Jr., understands the local problem.
The defendants feel that they have an inherited right to make whiskey and to transport whiskey. That is largely because their grandfathers made it before them, their fathers made it before them, and many of them have never known anything else. They all do come, however, from a fine stock. They are rugged individuals with little education, but outside of the whiskey business, you can be well assured that they are good citizens.
The logical question, it seemed to us, was to ask, if you know sooner or later you're going to get caught, why break the law of moonshining? This was the logical answer, mountain version.
Well, it's just like if you go out here tonight, you take a man, if he drinks a whole lot of whiskey. He goes into a bar and he gets drunk. He gets up in the morning, 9 out of 10 will go back to the bar if he has any money to get drunk again. And so why does he go back to get drunk?
Virginia's district court judge, A.D. Barksdale, has tried hundreds of moonshiners in his day. This is how he feels about the problem.
In rare instances, offenders violate the federal liquor laws because they're too lazy to do anything else. In the great majority of cases, however, economic conditions are a major factor. Many offenders find it impossible to make more than a meager livelihood, if that, by farming, and resort to moonshining in order to procure some additional comforts or small luxuries for their families. In some regions of the Blue Ridge and Appalachian Mountain areas, moonshining is traditional, and imprisonment is considered an occupational hazard involving no social stigma. The typical mountain moonshiner is a rugged character whose word is entirely dependable and whose only lapse from accepted standards of conduct is his violation of federal revenue laws. I use probation in more than half the cases, but violation of probation is without exception followed by a prison sentence, usually of from 1 to 2 years. Happily, there are very few probation violations.
If you want to know what America is, go out in the hinterlands of this country to the men who come at night to greet a wife and little children, who pay their taxes and love America.
For the past 20 minutes, you have been listening to some of the voices and sounds of one of America's mountain hinterlands.
If the ocean was whiskey and I was a duck, I would die to the bottom and I'd never come up. But well, I have to wait. Can I get you now, or must I hesitate?
You have just heard program 22 in the CBS series, Hear It Now, a document for air based on the week's news. Hear It Now is edited and produced by Edward R. Murrow and Fred W. Findlay, and a CBS staff which includes Joseph Wershfer, Edmund Scott, Jesse Zosma, John Aaron, and Irving Gitlin. Portions of the program originated at WTOP Washington, WRVA Richmond, KNX Los Angeles, and the British Broadcasting Corporation. Combat recordings were made in Korea by CBS correspondents Robert P. Martin and John Jefferson. Mr. Barrymore appeared through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of Go for Broke, starring Van Johnson. Edward R. Murrow can be heard over most of these same CBS stations Monday through Friday at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time. Olin Tye speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.